2021-70010, Brittany Marlowe Holberg versus Eric Guerrero et al. We'll hear first from Mr. Abernathy. Is it Nethy?
Abernathy.
Nethy. I apologize that I said Nathy. Thank you.
Good morning, may I please report David Abernathy for the appellant Brittany Holberg. The panel that first heard this case granted relief to Holberg based on her Brady claim, which was based on suppression of critical impeachment evidence about Vicki Kirkpatrick. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals found Ms. Kirkpatrick was a key prosecution witness in this case. She claimed that Holberg admitted in jail when they were together that she, Holberg, took money by force, robbed Mr. Towery, enjoyed killing Mr. Towery, felt no remorse, and would willingly kill again in the same circumstances. The prosecution never disclosed, and so the jury never heard, that Kirkpatrick was paid thousands of dollars as a paid police informant by the same department that procured her testimony against Holberg, or that those police knew that Kirkpatrick depended on their informant payments to feed her own drug habit, or that they bonded her out of jail and got a charge against her dismissed immediately after she gave a statement, or that Kirkpatrick lied to Holberg's jury, told the jury she testified only to be truthful and do the right thing, when in fact she was writing to the judge in her own felony case asking for probation as a reward for testifying against Holberg. The panel majority opinion and dissent accepted that this evidence was suppressed and would be helpful to Holberg, and the state didn't argue otherwise, but the majority and dissent parted company on whether the evidence was material either to guilt or sentence. It was to both. Kirkpatrick's testimony contradicted Holberg's claim of self-defense, but it also went directly to the robbery element required for capital murder. The state points in its brief to a variety of circumstantial evidence as supportive of robbery, but there's a great deal of other evidence that raises questions about that proof and points to reasonable doubt. We briefed that evidence, the state's brief largely ignores it. Perhaps most importantly, Kirkpatrick's testimony was the only testimony that went directly to Holberg's intent and the time when she formed intent. The prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Holberg formed an intent to steal from Towery before or during the commission of the homicide. An after-the-fact decision to steal would not suffice. That's not robbery, and therefore it's not capital murder. All of the other evidence presented for robbery that's outlined in the state's brief is equally consistent with a conclusion that Holberg and Towery had an argument that escalated into a violent struggle, that Holberg killed Towery, and whether or not it was self-defense or justified, that she decided after the fact that she was preparing to leave to take property. And that makes Kirkpatrick material, indeed critical, to capital murder. Even more so on sentence. She testified in the guilt-innocence phase, but that testimony was reintroduced on sentence, and a great deal of it went to the sentence and not to guilt. For example, the prosecutor's opening ended with a dramatic flourish based on Kirkpatrick's testimony, who claimed Holberg admitted she shoved a piece of a lamp, into Towery's throat because she wanted to silence the gagging noises he was making as he was dying. And the prosecutor finished by telling the jury, finally, the lamp to stop the gagging noises. I suspect you will hear the gagging noises, not in this courtroom, but in your thoughts, your sleep, and in your dreams, maybe for the rest of your lives. In the penalty phase, the prosecutor went back to this, his expert went to this, emphasized what he called the gratuitous use of the lamp, and in closing, the prosecutor told the jury, this scared both the expert and the DA. The jury heard Holmberg present herself in Kirkpatrick's telling as dangerous, sadistic, and utterly without remorse, and that unquestionably affected the sentencing decision in this case. It's confession evidence which has unique power. Kirkpatrick was untouched by any effective impeachment. The suppressed evidence would have destroyed her credibility, and the jury took 11 hours to reach a death sentence here when a different decision by one juror would have changed the outcome. Proceed a little on materiality, obviously ready for questions by the court.
Counsel, I have a question about page 31 of your red brief. It says, the state habeas, this is quoting your brief, the state habeas court ruled Holmberg was not entitled to relief because A, the prosecutor complied with Brady by opening his file to defendant, B, evidence is not suppressed if defendant already has it, and C, relief is available only if suppressed information is admissible. Where in the state habeas decision did the state habeas court say that?
That's in the conclusions of law that are stated in the original state habeas ruling.
I'm looking at page 9763, which is your citation for the proposition, and I'm looking at paragraphs 1 and 2, which is what you cited for the proposition. I see nothing to even remotely come close to supporting what you said. So where does the state habeas court say A, B, or C?
Well, obviously we read the decision differently, Your Honor, because...
Can you show it to me? Would you read it to me?
I don't have that page right in front of me, but you're referring to the page that we cited. The state court made a variety of holdings. Made a variety of findings of facts unrelated to Kirkpatrick, a variety to other things, and then in the conclusions of law addressed the Brady claim, all of the Brady claims together, and explained in its conclusions that it concluded Kirkpatrick, or that Holbert, rather, had not established an entitlement to relief for the Brady claim, and it laid out those reasons.
The entire analysis, the entire holding of the case, to correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just reading it to you. Holmberg has failed to show that the state violated its obligations under Brady versus Maryland. That's 9764, paragraph 3. Where does the state habeas court say any of the things that you attributed to it? I mean, you said in a brief that you filed in our court, the state habeas court ruled Holmberg was not entitled to relief for A, B, and C.
We can't hear you over here. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this not on?
Speak into the mic.
You said that the state habeas court made three holdings, A, B, and C. I'm asking you where the state habeas court made them.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point, Your Honor.
Okay.
Obviously, you disagree on how we're reading the state habeas court's decision, but the court laid out findings and then specifically addressed the Brady claim and set forth three reasons and stated that I should be clear, that section of the decision doesn't specifically refer to Kirkpatrick. It also doesn't specifically refer to other aspects of the Brady claim that were presented to that court. It addressed the Brady claim all in a single section, and as we read that decision, this is the state court explaining the basis for its decision to reject the Brady claim.
And if I'm understanding the point, you're saying that because the state habeas court never mentions, because Kirkpatrick, if I'm understanding it, you filed an eight-part Brady claim. So this is ground for relief 34 of 35 in the state habeas application. There's eight subparts to it. Becky Bates, John Sneed, Katina Dixon, part four is Kirkpatrick, then Speer, Norell, Frazier, and Burnett. And because the state habeas court doesn't discuss each of them individually, there is no holding under which we would apply AEDPA's relitigation bar. Is that the argument?
No, our argument, with which the state disagrees, obviously, our argument is that the state court decision sets forth the reasons for denying the Brady claim as applicable to all the aspects of the Brady claim. The state takes the view that section, although it doesn't specifically exclude the Kirkpatrick claim, is intended to not apply to the Kirkpatrick claim. We disagree with that for the reasons stated in our brief, but I would add that if in fact the state habeas court gave reasons for denying the Brady claim, but somehow did not intend them to apply to Kirkpatrick, then this would be a situation in which the claim, Brady claim relating to Kirkpatrick, was properly presented, exhausted in the state court, but not addressed at all, in which case I think, I'm looking for the case, I think it's Johnson v. Williams, would justify de novo review.
Is it de novo review as to all eight parts of the Brady claim?
I don't know that that's necessarily the case, Your Honor, but we have a certificate only to appeal the claim related to Kirkpatrick. So whether or not, whatever the standard would be for the other aspects of the Brady claim, they're not appealed here, and we can't appeal them here. So.
Well, of course, we could grant a COA at any time, and we could obviously expand the COA. So I'm asking you if your theory of de novo review applies to all eight subparts of ground 34 of 35 in the state habeas application.
No, Your Honor, what I'm trying to suggest is that if the state habeas court didn't address them, even though properly preserved, de novo relief would be appropriate. But that ultimately, we're not arguing that the state habeas court didn't address the claim. We're arguing they addressed the claim and they set forth the reasons there in the decision. And those are the reasons that apply to Kirkpatrick. We have argued that de novo review should apply to the materiality element of the Brady claim as to Kirkpatrick because it wasn't addressed in the state habeas court's reasons. But I would add to that, ultimately, we don't believe that whether it's de novo review or it's review under the standard in 2254, that doesn't ultimately govern the outcome.
Can you address the standard under 2254D1 about what makes the state court's application of Brady objectively unreasonable as opposed to a close call? Can you address that and what your best case is for that, assuming arguendo that it does apply and that it was addressed under materiality?
Right, Your Honor. The state habeas court referred to an open file policy, but there's nothing in the record that indicates that the suppressed impeachment information was in any open file that the prosecution provided to Holbert's lawyers. The state habeas court also refers to...
Was it in the file?
There's nothing in the record, to my knowledge, Your Honor, that would indicate that any of this information was in any file that the prosecution furnished to Holberg or her lawyers.
What do you say about the affidavit that Holberg's original trial counsel filed in 2011, where she explained why she did not cross-examine Kirkpatrick more diligently?
Well, several things, Your Honor.
She says she knew about Kirkpatrick being a paid informant, correct?
That's the state's argument. That's not what the record shows.
The affidavit says?
No, and I'd like to unpack that a little bit if I could, Your Honor. This argument was not argued below in the state habeas court or in the district court or in the original merits
briefing.
Well,
frankly, the argument about Brady and Kirkpatrick was number 33 in your points on appeal or in habeas, so it couldn't have been the most important to you either, but leave that.
So the affidavit that is referred to here was made by trial counsel 13 years after trial, and it addressed at the state court's direction specific ineffective assistance of counsel issues that had been raised in habeas. In one of those points, and all of the arguments about Kirkpatrick and the impeachment being suppressed were already on the record in habeas and had been reviewed by trial counsel at the time she made this affidavit, so she was aware of all these issues and arguments. What she addressed was an ineffective assistance of counsel issue, arguing that she should have called a reputation witness to testify that Kirkpatrick had a bad reputation for truthfulness. And she made several arguments as to why that wouldn't have made any difference, first being that she was, the community in question was criminals and prostitutes, but also she said that if she had presented that reputation witness, law enforcement might have testified that Kirkpatrick provided helpful information to them in another case. There's absolutely nothing in the affidavit about any information that Kirkpatrick was a paid police informant or any of the other impeaching evidence that we've argued was known to the state but suppressed. Actually, later in the declaration, the same trial counsel talks about another claim that she should have cross-examined Kirkpatrick differently or more aggressively. In that section of the declaration, she doesn't say anything at all about Kirkpatrick providing information to the police as a reason for not cross-examining her.
Mr. Abernathy, I hope you can get to the argument that Texas and the courts have been considering for the last 10 years as to materiality. But just a nail on disclosure, has Texas ever pointed in 10 years in federal habeas to a place in the record showing contemporaneous discovery disclosure of paid informant status?
There's nothing in the record.
Has any state or federal court in 20 years ever pointed and found that it was disclosed?
No, there's nothing.
Did the district court assume it wasn't disclosed in over 100%, quoting corporate Stallings, who said himself sworn testimony under oath, no one until today knew Ms. Kirkpatrick had been an assistant to the Amarillo Police Department.
Yes, Your Honor.
If it had been disclosed, would it be constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel to not use it for cross?
I think it
okay. So my questions are on what you've had to litigate for the last 10 years in federal court, which is whether or not this is material. And I have a question factually and I have a question legally. Are you saying when the government uses a paid informant to be their government agent witness and doesn't disclose it, that's always material? Or are you saying in these facts, capital case, defendant own words accusing herself, and not just grisly murder, but actually will do grisly murders again? Which is it? Is it factually always material legally, or is it factually this case?
I'm not arguing that in every case, as a matter of law, a failure to, I'm arguing you have to disclose that your key witness is a paid police informant. Is it material? There might be cases in which it's not material. I do think that depends on the facts. But here you had a situation where there's a violent struggle between two individuals. The defendant is claiming self-defense. It may have been a violent struggle that escalated to homicide, where self-defense ultimately wasn't supported, but that's still a very different situation from a sadistic, gratuitous killing, and it's a very different situation from a situation
under Kyles and Strickler. Do we ever say, oh, it's not material because there's sufficient other evidence as a matter of law? Or is your position that, yes, we can look at whether there was overwhelming other proof, but here, this, in the minds of the jury, had to have affected whether or not they would return a death verdict?
I think you can look at the facts. You have to look at the facts, and you have to review the whole record. And it's not, obviously, a matter of whether it had to change the jury's mind, but whether there's a reasonable probability, whether the evidence put the case in a different light, in order to, with respect to the issue, whether it's guilt or sentence. But I want to emphasize, with respect to guilt, a jury might have decided other evidence just doesn't get you to self-defense. Maybe they found other evidence gets them to the conclusion that Holberg took something from Towery when she left his apartment. But that still leaves a really critical question, which is, when was the intent formed?
Counsel, so I have a question about the lamp down the throat, and then I have a question about the wad of bills that she had on her after the killing. First, the lamp down the throat, you focused on that. You said it was the climax of the prosecution's presentation to the jury, the lamp down the throat to stop the gurgling. If Kirkpatrick had been impeached, and the jury didn't believe her anymore. What's the alternative theory in your mind for how the lamp ended up down the throat?
Well, there was evidence both from the scene, forensic evidence from the scene, and from Holbert's testimony that there was a lengthy, extended, violent struggle. She testified that in the course of that struggle, she used the lamp as a defensive weapon, trying to strike out at Towery. And
so the theory is, in self-defense, she shoved the lamp down his throat.
Well, self-defense is only one aspect, Your Honor, because there's also a materiality of sentencing issue here. I think this is more sentencing, but...
Well, I mean, let's stay with the lamp. The autopsy report showed that it was shoved so far down his throat that it nicked his carotid artery. So I'm just struggling with, okay, let's say Kirkpatrick is impeached. I'm on the jury. Okay, now I understand the lamp down the throat was in self-defense. Is that the theory?
That's a theory relating to guilt or innocence.
Okay.
But in terms of sentence, Your Honor, the testimony from Kirkpatrick that's critically important is that Holbert said, I got tired of listening to his gurgling or gagging noises as he's dying, so I shoved the lamp down his throat because I didn't want to listen to them anymore. That involves a level of sadism and cruelty that has, I think, clearly a very direct impact on sentence.
So okay. 57 stab wounds is not sadistic with three different implements?
Well, in a 45-minute struggle in which...
Most humans can't imagine being stabbed once, much less nearly five dozen times, while trying to fight back. I'm just, you know, this is sort of my layman's scared of crime belief.
Well, a jury, Your Honor, I think, obviously they're considering the violence and the number of wounds, but they're also considering the context, the trauma that Holberg experienced, the grounds she had to be in fear. In terms of the sentencing, did she use that? Was it a sadistic? Was it a desire to be cruel or excessive? That's an issue the jury had to consider. And in the context of a situation where this was not a calculated, planned violent attack, she didn't bring a weapon with her. All the weapons that were used, there was a fork, there was a kitchen knife.
Scissors.
And all of those things were things that were grabbed in the situation at the scene.
Can I just also ask, I meant to ask you about the robbery. So you said the Kirkpatrick testimony was also material as to robbery. So if Kirkpatrick's testimony had been impeached, then the jury could have come to a different conclusion on the robbery, the robbery motive, right, which was an aggravating factor.
Right.
So what I want to ask you about is, I thought there's testimony in the record from Cody Mayo and his girlfriend Misty Votaw, that after the killing, Holberg offered them $200 for a ride. She had pulled out a wad of cash. One of the bills was bloodstained. Now, that testimony doesn't have anything to do with Kirkpatrick. So why isn't the testimony about robbery, the evidence, so overwhelming that undermining Kirkpatrick on that just doesn't make any difference?
I think, Your Honor, that in terms of materiality to guilt, Kirkpatrick is most clearly material to guilt because of the robbery element requirement that she had to form the intent to take the property by force either before or during that commission of the act. Let's imagine that the jury looked at the bills, looked at all the other evidence of the state's outline and said, I believe she took either money or drugs or both. That doesn't answer the question, did she form the intent to do that after the homicide? That makes her guilty of homicide and guilty of theft, but it's not capital murder. None of the other evidence goes directly to that, but Kirkpatrick does because she testified that Holberg said to her, I went there to get money, I asked him for money, he wouldn't give it to me, so I took it from him, and while taking it from him, I killed him. Okay. That's direct evidence of the robbery element with the mens rea at the appropriate time. But that's the only evidence. The other evidence.
Can we turn I'm sorry.
Counsel, I was going to, did Ms. Kirkpatrick testify dressed in a prison outfit, prison uniform? Do you know?
I believe she was in jail clothing, and it was, she was, it did come out in a cross that she had a criminal charge.
She had criminal charges pending, so it would have been readily apparent to everyone in the courthouse that, in fact, she was testifying and that she would hope to get some benefit later on from her testimony. So your, as I understand your complaint here, your position is that it's her informant status as to other crimes wherein she cooperated with the district attorney's office. Is that correct?
I know I'm out of time, Doug.
Yes, please. And yes, I have a question.
She actually flatly denied when she testified that she had any kind of deal or promise or expected any kind of deal or promise. What's impeaching that wasn't known was the people who took her statement against Holbert, the Amarillo police, were paying her all this money in other cases. Of course, employment by the adverse party is always.
Okay, well, I'm trying to focus on your complaint that she was an informant, a paid informant, on other crimes not associated with this one. And that is what, as I understand your argument, makes her a biased or a self-interested witness. Do you know if any of the times when she was a paid informant in the past, she had given testimony or other information that proved false?
I don't think there's anything in the record that points to any case where she gave false testimony, but it isn't only the thing that's part of it. It's also the fact that while she's telling the jury in this case, I don't expect anything, I'm just here to do the right thing, she's writing to her judge saying, I want you to give me probation, among other reasons, because I testified against Holbert.
Mr. Abernethy, you've also briefed a claim about ineffective assistance of counsel. And it's unclear to me what the position is. Is the position that any strategy that's described now, this girl next door strategy, that she wouldn't be threatening in the community, was a post hoc rationalization to justify poor choices of not doing a proper mitigation? Or was it that it was the strategy and we're sticking to it no matter what we find out that's contrary to the strategy that would actually support a much stronger strategy, but we've run out of time? What is the argument on this? It's not, you know, our panel opinions have been vacated and they didn't really address it, but the district court addressed it, it's addressed in your briefs. Can you please tell us what your argument is on this point?
I think the primary argument here, Your Honor, is that the defense counsel made a decision at the outset of the case as to what their strategy was going to be. They refused to vary it even when there were multiple red flags that showed things they should have been pursuing. They made the decision, oh, we're not going to look into anything that's not recent. So they didn't look into any of the early childhood trauma or being born with symptoms of addiction to drugs and all of these other things, and they're outlined in the brief. I don't want to catalog every one of them, but The key point, Your Honor, is that they enabled a situation by refusing to investigate, refusing to look at these other issues, where the prosecution was able to present a false narrative that this woman had a perfectly normal childhood with loving parents. There's a little bit of marijuana use in the house, not a big deal. She had love. Everything. They said everything was handled to her on a silver platter. That's so far from the reality that could have been presented.
Okay.
It's really stunning.
And is that reviewed? Is that reviewed under the deferential ethical standard, or is any part of that reviewed de novo?
I believe, Your Honor, that the ineffective performance is subject to 2254 review, but the state, I think, has conceded earlier in the case that prejudice wasn't addressed and would be subject to de novo review.
Okay,
I think they acknowledge that.
Thank you. Unless my colleague has a further question, you save time for rebuttal. Do you have a question?
I do have a question. I have a couple of questions. Is an informant's credibility a Brady fact that needs to be known?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that both exculpatory evidence and impeaching evidence about a prosecution witness is subject to Brady, and we're obviously in the latter category here, so it would have to have been disclosed. These facts, we would argue, have to have been disclosed.
Is there any evidence in the record that the police department itself determined that Ms. Kirkpatrick was not a credible witness?
There was this inferential evidence. Kirkpatrick's case was heard, her burglary case, several weeks after Holberg's trial. In that case, the prosecutor really savaged Kirkpatrick's credibility, pointed out to the court that she lied about how many prior felonies she had, that she lied about how many burglaries she was involved in. So certainly shortly after the trial, there's evidence that makes clear that they knew that she had a serious credibility problem.
Did Corporal Stallings testify at her sentencing that because she told him the day he got her out on bond, the day she gave her statement, that she had committed 30 or 40 robberies and only got charged with one, that he decided not to use her anymore after that?
I recall that there was testimony about the commission of the number of burglaries she had been involved in. Candidly, Your Honor, I'm having a hard time recalling specifically whether he testified that was a reason to not use her. Stallings' testimony is in full in the record from the burglary case, and we've cited to some of that, so it would be there, but I don't want to mislead Your Honor that I have a specific recollection of that precise point.
Seeing no other questions, you have saved time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from Mr. Cole now.
Thank you, Chief Judge Elrod, and may it please the court. If I can, I'd like to refocus the court on AEDPA, which I think is the most straightforward way to resolve this claim. Of course, our position is that the court should affirm the district court's denial of habeas because the litigation bar forecloses both the Brady and the Strickland claims. Now, on the Brady claim, we have two arguments, the D1 argument with respect to materiality, and then the D2 argument with respect to, the D2 argument with respect to suppression. Materiality, D1, is probably, frankly, the most straightforward way to resolve this case. And Judge Oldham, you're asking about where do we look for this? And I agree with you in your line of questions and your colloquy that there aren't reasons for this confidential informant theory. And so the Richter presumption of merits adjudication requires us to look at, under Harrington and under Sexton, in cases like that, in the opinion of Jimenez, the reasons that could have supported the judgment.
Counsel, before you get to there, it seems to me the question of whether there were reasons could be usefully explored. The three paragraphs in the 2012, I guess it is, district court opinion, the state habeas court opinion, first paragraph lays out the basics of Brady. The second paragraph concerns me is, I looked through the findings, 130-some-odd pages, is there anything in there where an open file policy by the prosecutor is identified factually? Is it accepted in this case that there was such a policy? And are there findings to that effect?
I don't believe there are findings as to the open file policy, but that's not one of the reasons that we believe the court gave.
What I'm asking really is, you have argued that this is first two paragraphs are just setting out the rules of the road, and then having fully explored all the ways that you could understand Brady and the ways that you could show a violation, last paragraph says no violation. What I'm wondering is, it does seem to me to be an incomplete list, the second paragraph primarily. But I don't know if it's at all valid to read, and I know you think it doesn't, I would say it's probably not valid to read this open file policy as a reason unless there are findings in the order that there was such a policy. And you're saying there, that's not in the record.
And let me be clear, Judge Southwick, we're not making an argument for the open file policy. We're not saying that's the rule of law that you apply here. The rule of law at issue for the materiality element, we would say, is banked. But when we're looking to the reasons, what are the reasons? I take that to be an application of law fact. The reason given is this is basically, like in Richter, in our view, an unreasoned state court opinion. And what we do is...
It's not an unreasoned if the court opinion was saying there's an open file policy and... the evidence shows this information probably wasn't in the policy. And I'm not explaining myself very well, but I'm trying to get to it. That can't be the reason unless there's evidence that there was an open file policy.
That's right. That's not the reason for the rejection of the confidential informant Brady claim. Maybe a couple to consider, as Judge Jones was mentioning, as Judge Holden was mentioning, it's like an eight-part Brady claim. There's all sorts of Katina Dixon, there's John Sneed. And as some cases from this court, the Nelson case indicate that when we're thinking about a Brady claim, it really is evidence-specific. And so we're really training our focus, I think the court should, on the confidential informant theory. And when we're asking, are there reasons the state court offered for rejecting the confidential informant theory, we say no. There are no reasons. The open file policy isn't one of them. So I don't think you would look at that when you're sussing out whether there are reasons given. Now, assuming I satisfied you with that, Judge Southwick, I think the reason that we see the only thing is Holbert has failed to show that the state violated its obligations under Brady versus Maryland. When we see that, that's essentially, I would say, akin to a summary denial of the claim. And when you have that, Harrington, Sexton, Scorch, Pitting, Menez, indicates we look to what reasons could have supported the judgment. So if I can go to the reasons that could have supported the judgment, we have the argument about banks. When we're talking about D1 suspected materiality, the question is this an unreasonable application of banks, or the contrary to banks? And we would suggest no on both prongs. I'll talk about the contrary to prong in this court's decision in Langley, indicates that...
Why not just factually, for me, it would be helpful, because like the panel, like the district court quoting corporate Stallings, I'm going to assume it wasn't disclosed. So the question is materiality, and your position is it was not material to the defense or to a jury that returns a verdict of death to know that the only accusing witness was actually a government agent being paid, and that witness is the only, correct me if any of these are wrong, that witness is the only witness that tells the jury that Holberg herself accused herself of felony murder. No one else said what the jury had just heard from Holberg with no prior conviction. She takes the stand, capital defendant, takes the stand, says that the man that's been paying her for sex for years initiated the fight and she killed him. She admits that, but she says self-defense. There's no other witness that says, actually, Holberg herself told me in jail that she loved killing him and described in detail the gruesome. In fact, tell me, Kirkpatrick is the only witness that the government put on to say that Holberg said the more she stabbed her, the prettier it was. Kirkpatrick is the only witness that said that Holberg said, her exact words were, it's fun and it's amazing. And Kirkpatrick is the only witness the jury heard that said that if Holberg had to do it all over again, she would anything to get drugs and money. Fact question, is there any other witness that the government put on that said that the defendant's own words would that she boasted she'd do it again for drugs and money?
So there's a lot packed in there.
No, it's just a fact question. Is there any other witness that the government said that Holberg's own words should convict her and sentence her to death?
The only testimony is Holberg's words and Kirkpatrick, but there's a couple of things in there. If I could start with this, I think the analysis you're asking about is a de novo analysis. Again, this is EDPA. You don't get to the sort of de novo question of was this material, was this not, unless Ms. Holberg can clear the relitigation bar. And the question...
But you agree the state habeas court said nothing other than Brady denied with a paragraph before saying open files. No state court ever... No federal court, no state court ever has said what you're asking us to say, which is paid witness status for a person who says the defendant convicted herself is actually immaterial.
Well, what I'm asking you to say, Judge Higginson, is that the relitigation bar under is the relitigation bar forecloses the claim because there's been no unreasonable application of the Supreme Court precedent in banks, and there's no contrary to precedent in banks. That's
okay, so but then it's the same question. Isn't it unreasonable for a court to say it's immaterial to the defense and ultimately the jury that gives the verdict of death, it was immaterial, didn't prejudice the defense. And here are the four places that I would see prejudice, again, disagree. When Kirkpatrick testifies to all that, only six pages of cross, not a single question that the government might have purchased his testimony, correct?
So we do not think that there's been an application of Supreme Court precedent in which the state habeas corpus reasons, again.
But there was no cross at all that this is purchased testimony.
There's no cross.
Okay, and then at closing, the defense barely grasps at anything to impeach Kirkpatrick, starting out saying, well, really, could the blood have been spurting like a fountain? So they had no ability to test that she was testifying because the government was paying
her. Again, I want
to... No. I yes or no, and I have two other yes or no questions. And then I'm just asking factually. When the government, in rebuttal closing, gets up and says to the jury, you can believe Kirkpatrick, maybe Holberg isn't a vampire, but you can believe everything Kirkpatrick said because the details are so graphic. No ability to object. And finally, if this had been disclosed, paid government informed status, do you agree that under our jury instructions and under Supreme Court law, this jury would have been told they had to consider paid informant testimony with great caution and care? That's our mandatory instruction.
I think that goes to favorability. We're not really disputing favorability.
No, it goes to materiality. Isn't it true? It would be reversible error if a district court didn't give that instruction that the defense asked for because you had disclosed it. But now you're saying because you didn't disclose it, it's not reversible error that they didn't get it. The Supreme Court's case in Hoffa in 1966, two years before Brady, said the only reason we can trust testimony like this, such an incentive to lie, so compromised, is because Anglo-American safeguards exist, two of them, cross-examination and a court instructing the jury, be very careful. Ms. Holberg got neither, but it's not material.
There has been no misapplication of Supreme Court precedent. I think maybe we're talking past each other. I want to address your question, but really the threshold question here is, has there been a misapplication of Banks? I don't understand them to be saying that there's a misapplication of Hoffa. I understand them to be saying, is there a misapplication of Banks? And Banks says, when there is an undisclosed informant who's an informant in unrelated cases, when in the words of this court, it's independent of the relationship, the police and informant's relationship is independent of the things that led to the indictment, then it's not material.
So when you say the words of this court, you mean the Dennis decision?
The Dennis decision.
Okay, they're the informant that was, the informant didn't even testify at guilt, correct?
In Dennis?
Yeah. Okay, the informant, there's no evidence that it was a paid informant.
So you might disagree with Dennis, but it's
No, I'm asking you, when you say, in the words of this court, it's like Dennis, that witness for the government didn't even testify at the guilt phase, didn't involve saying this defendant's own words accused herself, and the informant wasn't paid. Do you have any case of any appellate court, state or federal, ever upholding a death verdict when the government put on its key witness, but the government withheld that's actually a government agent who's their agent for hire? Do you have any case that you cited in your brief ever that upholds guilt, death guilt, when the government doesn't turn over that evidence?
Well, I'm not sure that's our burden. Their burden is to show that they've been
So you don't have a case?
Dennis is the best case I have for you, but
it's not a guilt phase witness, it's not a confession testimony, it's not paid evidence.
And those are material distinctions, but if you disagree with Dennis, maybe you think that...
No, I don't disagree with Dennis.
But I would submit to you that there's a material distinction between Dennis and Banks. And that's the question here. And I don't think you can say there's an unreasonable application. Maybe you disagree, but that it would have to be an error in the words of the Supreme Court so well-founded in law that you could say no fair-minded jurist...
But that's why I said Hoffa. The Supreme Court has told us what we do with false friend testimony. Government puts the false friend in the jailhouse. We know from Fifth Circuit pattern instructions, then that person elicits the molten core fulminante. Oh, this defendant has convicted herself. And we know state, if she were retried in state court, Texas would give her two separate special instructions had you disclosed this evidence. Number one, jailhouse instruction. Number two, covert agent instruction. Texas gives two. She got none of this.
So, So let me, maybe I can direct, go to your de novo question directly. I think I've made my point on that.
Yeah, you have.
Let's talk about the materiality standards. So Turner says that you need to look at the entire trial record and you need to look to see whether, the withheld evidence in the context of the entire record and determine in the light of that examination whether there's a reasonable probability that had the evidence been disclosed, the results of the proceeding would have been different or would have undermined confidence, right, in the verdict. And there's at least sort of three levels here. We're talking about self-defense, so let's talk about self-defense. And this court's cases, by the way, of course, say when you have strong corroboration by additional evidence for a guilty verdict, it's not material, and it's less likely to be material. And so let's talk about what we have. On self-defense, I think the most powerful testimony was from the medical examiner, and there's a reason that the prosecutor got up at his closing and hit the table 57 times. He's calling attention to, as Judge Jones mentioned, the 57 stab wounds. Also very powerful was her testimony of self-defense itself. I mean, she had no explanation for why Mr. Towery had 18 stab wounds in the back. Her explanation for why he had 9 defensive wounds on his hand was that he was holding my hair for most of the time and I was trying to let go. But of course, the testimony was that Mr. Towery was health problems. He was feeble. It took him 45 minutes to walk 4 blocks. That was the testimony the jury heard. And so on self-defense, I think the most powerful testimony was not the 19 pages of Kirkpatrick. It was the testimony about the crime scene investigator, Sergeant Medina. It was the medical examiner, again, with blow by blow, and it was her testimony. Now, what the panel had mentioned that, well, maybe Ms. Kirkpatrick wouldn't have testified. And there's a finding of fact on that from the state habeas court, and presumed correct on 2254E1, that actually at the outset, and I'll give you the record site here, it is ROA 98028. Holberg was insistent from the outset on wishing to testify and to present self-defense at the guilt innocence phase of the trial. And after her counsel explained to her the risks of that, however, Holberg consistently and adamantly expressed the desire to testify. So I think the case was quite overwhelming. Additional evidence corroborating Kirkpatrick's testimony. And I know there was a dispute between the panel majority and the dissent about is the sufficiency of the evidence analysis, is it not? And the way I'm viewing that testimony, essentially, this is sort of an additive exercise. You don't remove the Kirkpatrick testimony and say what's left. It's adding impeaching evidence in and say, what do we think the result was? And when you have additional powerful evidence corroborating it, I think, as you have here, you can't say it's material. On future dangerousness, I think my friends on the other side, rightly at page 50 of their brief, said the brutality of the crime was enough to show future dangerousness, but you also have testimony in the record that she may have beaten an elderly man over the head with a cane. She thought she killed him. Now, of course, I won't say there was a dispute about whether she actually killed him there, but the jury heard evidence that she did that. The jury heard from Katina Dixon that she had paid, she wanted to have Kirkpatrick killed. She had testimony about violent tendencies with respect to her ex-husband, cuts, broken nose, all this stuff. So the evidence of future dangerousness was, I would submit to you, again, overwhelming, totally independent of and corroborated by, independent of the Kirkpatrick testimony, but helps corroborate the inquiry into future dangerousness. There was some talk about robbery, so let me go to that. The evidence, again, was strongly corroborative of robbery. She shows up to Mr. Towery's apartments, very strung up, very high, and she has not very much money. There was some testimony that she said, well, maybe you had $250 or $300, but we know she's just the cab driver, the $20 fare, and walks the fare. And then she goes into the apartment, and she's the one who introduces sort of the specter of money there. But we know that she's coming down, she's looking for a fix, and we have the strong evidence that she goes into the house without this much money, and she leaves with about the exact amount of money that was missing from the scene. We have the testimony from Mr. Towery's children that he was saving up to buy a car. We have the testimony from Ms. Vatow and Mr. Mayo about her spreading out the bills and counting them. There's testimony that there was blood on the bills, and she spends the night buying crack cocaine with his money and partying. So there's evidence that she took that money from him. Strong evidence that corroborates, again,
Is there actually evidence that there's blood on the bills? It seems that there's some sort of dispute between the briefs on that.
There was a dispute in the briefs. I do think the record shows that Mr. Mayo testified that Ms. Vata told him, I think that was the record, correct me if I'm wrong, that there was blood on the bills.
Someone told him that, but the bills themselves in the record don't show that. Is that the situation?
I'm not sure what the bills show, Judge Elrod, but the testimony was from Mr. Mayo that at least his partner, Ms. Vata, said there was blood on the bills.
But one of the arguments that your friend on the other side made today, and also in the brief, is that the intent to rob could have been formed post the murder. Do you wish to address that?
I'd be more than happy to, Chief Judge Elrod. I think the evidence is overwhelming and strong that it was not formed as sort of an afterthought to steal from him. Again, she says, she's the one who introduced in her testimony that he was throwing money at me, and it was there. And then we have the circumstantial evidence, I grant you for sure, strong circumstantial evidence that she left. She went there with not much money, and she left with a lot of it. I mean, there's a question in the jury's mind, right? Well, why did she kill him? I mean, her theory was, I was smoking crack, and then he came and got really angry. But her testimony was, I would submit to you, not very believable on this score. On that point,
counsel, why did she explain? Why in her view was a 11 inch lamp shoved, a lamp post shoved 11 inches down his throat, nicking the carotid artery? What was her explanation for the lamp down the throat?
Judge Duncan, it's a very muddled explanation, but it appears to me that she was engaged in some kind of defensive exercise, and the lamp just sort of happened to go down his throat. Facially implausible. The medical examiner testified that would be essentially a miracle if that happened, and he said that it was most likely that she shoved it down his throat, not in some sort of defensive mode. Because the precision that would have to, you'd have to do that while engaged in a 45-minute allegedly fight would be amazing.
I believe the medical examiner also testified that the bleeding associated with the lamp down the throat showed that he was alive when she shoved the lamp down his throat.
Yes.
Okay. After the jury heard that testimony, heard about the lamp and all of that, the jury heard that she would do it again for money, according to the informant. Why would that? I'm still unclear. Can you explain why that's not material to the sentencing? The fact that I'm pretty cold-blooded. Not only did I have glee when I did this, but that I would do it again for money. Why isn't that pertinent to the or material, not just pertinent?
So a couple of reasons, Chief Judge Elrod. First, the prosecutor actually, I think, sort of sadly, according to the argument, said, "This is what Kirkpatrick said, but this was puffery. This was jailhouse talk. We don't actually think that she really enjoyed this. This was just trying to make her look bad." So I think he sort of blunted the force of that. But the second thing is that
counsel, he argued that in closing, but he didn't actually ask Kirkpatrick if she thought Holberg really meant it, though. Correct?
No, he didn't ask her that. I mean, it's contextualizing the evidence. But the other argument, the more powerful argument in response to Chief Judge Elrod's question, is the other independent evidence of future dangerousness. Again, my friends on the other side, in their brief, say the brutality of the crime alone, set aside Kirkpatrick, the 58 stabbings, the lamp down the throat, which was, as Judge Duncan said, not explained at all by Ms. Holberg during her testimony. But also beating over the head over another man who she thought she killed, trying to get another inmate to kill Vicki Kirkpatrick. This is all testimony about future dangerousness in the record that is separate and apart from Kirkpatrick that I think would satisfy a jury that there's plenty of evidence of future dangerousness.
Well, as to whether Kirkpatrick was decisive both for felony murder, the robbery, and future dangerousness, the DA, Farron, that's where he started with Kirkpatrick. The first answer he elicits is Kirkpatrick saying, Holberg told, so the jury's hearing, Holberg said that what happened was the man she had some money on, she wanted it. He was one of her old sugar daddies that had taken care of her for years. And then Farron comes back at the very end and elicits exactly that, both felony status and future dangerousness, getting Kirkpatrick to say that Holberg said that she'd do it all over again. Yes, she would. Question, why? For drugs. Do you remember her saying anything like she'd do it to get drugs or drug money? Yeah, yes, I do.
And again, as I was explaining to Chief Judge, there's other evidence besides this testimony, which again, and I think Judge Ramirez's point that the district attorney didn't ask her about Kirkpatrick about this, but he contextualizes it in closing for the jury and says, we don't actually think she's so savage as to enjoy it. This was jailhouse talk.
But then in rebuttal closing, the prosecutor comes back and says, we don't believe her, literally, the word he uses is that Holberg is a vampire. Don't believe that that's what she enjoys, drinking the blood. But do believe her in her details.
Yes.
No, so the prosecutor rebuttal closing, no defensibility to respond. What does he return to? Kirkpatrick. And Kirkpatrick, her details are so good. She did it for drugs and money. She'll do it again. She has no remorse. But that's not material to a jury. That there are two questions while they're deliberating or about whether it was robbery.
In the light of the entire trial record, Judge James, I agree. When you isolate it like that, wow, that seems really powerful. But again, in the light of the whole trial record, no, it's not.
But isn't the DA the one who elicited the testimony about Holberg thinking the gushing blood looked pretty? Isn't he the one who asked Kirkpatrick, and did she say anything about the blood looking pretty?
It came out from Kirkpatrick's testimony, Judge Ramirez.
In response to his specific question. I know it was in her affidavit, but she didn't testify to it. He specifically asked her about those statements, correct?
He did ask her about those statements, and you know, and the response from the defense was actually, well, the fountain of blood seems implausible because there's no arterial bleed that wasn't shooting everywhere. But separately, again, I think the prosecutor took a lot of the sting out of that when he said, we don't believe she was that callous. We think it was jailhouse talk, which is exactly right. But the reason we should believe her is not because of the explosive nature of those, the explosive, descriptive nature of those descriptions, but the fact that she had details that only Kirkpatrick could have told, that Holberg could have told her.
Well, then why elicit? Why elicit it? If she didn't say that on her own, then why specifically ask her if that's his intent?
Well, there was certainly the record, the affidavit there that was there, so I suppose the defense could have asked her about it. But if I'm not making headway with you on the Kirkpatrick point, I think, again, there's a whole trove of evidence, which is why I think my friends on the other side say that the brutality of the crime alone, the savage nature of the crime alone, is enough to show future dangerousness.
Then why put a paid informant on the stand if you don't need her, if she's the only evidence of intent?
Well, she's certainly, I'm not going to hear say that she's not helpful, but again, the question is, the prosecutor's decisions, the whole trial record, what does that show? When you put it in context, it's not, I don't think it's material.
Well, let's talk about it.
When you say it's not the prosecutor's intent, it is the prosecutor's intent. The prosecutor's the only one that knows this is a witness we've been paying in 40 different drug cases. So the prosecutor would, if they don't slightly, at the very last, say, oh, you might not want to believe her in anything. What they're doing is protecting themselves from a radioactive Brady claim turning into a NAPU claim that the government withholds evidence and then elicits a lie. Of course they can't say, believe her, because they know they've withheld devastating impeachment.
I don't know that there's any evidence in the record suggesting the prosecutors would intentionally withheld this.
Yeah, counsel, I was going to ask you that. Is there a NAPU claim in this case that the prosecutors, is that even before this court?
It's not. It was rejected on the merits in the state court.
I don't remember any NAPU claim at all in this case. I don't understand why we're talking about it.
I think Judge Jones has a question.
I had a question. If Kirkpatrick hadn't testified, would we be here today about whether she was a future danger?
No.
So the argument of the defense is basically because you put on a jailbird witness who elaborated about the jailhouse confession, that would have caused one and said this person has made other cases in where she may or may not have even testified. And she might even have written to the judge seeking leniency, which, by the way, she didn't get, that would have made one juror decide she wasn't worthy of the death penalty. That's it.
That seems to be their argument, and as you note, there is whole other independent evidence. Again, there's evidence in the record that Kirkpatrick thought she killed another elderly man by beating him over the head with a cane. I don't want to overstate it. There was evidence from the defense that, well, the cause of death may have been cancer, maybe not. But the evidence was that she beat another individual over the head, another sugar daddy, with a cane, and thought she killed him. There's also the violence with respect to her ex-husband.
Well, given the violence in the record, it seems that I want to ask a couple questions about the Strickland.
Absolutely.
Because it would seem that this strategy to try to have her be a person that could be back in society would be the world's worst strategy, and it also might seem that, and maybe that's not actionable to have the world's worst strategy, but I would like you to opine on that. But also, it seems that the trial was the mitigation phase of the trial, the dangerousness determination, it was not the actual facts at all of what her life was. So what I want to know, at the time that this testimony was proffered, that she just had a normal life until she went boy crazy and she qualified for the Duke tip, but she didn't actually qualify for the Duke tip. But other than that, did the prosecutor and the defense counsel know at the trial that she had been addicted to drugs at birth and that her sibling was stillborn from being addicted? Did the prosecutor and the defense counsel know that at the time this testimony was offered at the mitigation phase, at the dangerousness phase?
I don't know that they knew that. I'm not sure whether or not that is true that she was addicted to drugs at birth. I think you're going to a Wiggins type question.
I have a whole series. Did the prosecution and the defense counsel know that she was molested at age 4 or 5 and that her mother punished her when she reported the molestation and then left her again in the molester's care? Did the prosecution and the defense counsel know that?
So Holberg testified to that on the stand. She testified about her, so the jury heard this.
So the jury, did they know that there was something in that or not?
I'm sorry, something?
Did they know that from the other relatives, the extended relatives at the time? The prosecutor
and the defense counsel? I believe her stepfather testified that she was gang raped. There's no dispute that this is very sad.
At 4 or 5, that she'd been molested at 4 or 5.
There was some testimony from herself that she was sexually assaulted by babysitter. Yes, I mean the jury heard from Ms. Holberg. Oh, not a certain amount of time.
I'm sorry, I have a couple more.
Yeah,
did the defense counsel and the prosecution know that the stepfather, who appeared to be just this great stepfather, was repeatedly sexualizing her?
There's no evidence. There's no evidence in the record that that's the case.
Not false testimony put on by anybody.
Not aware of that. So the district, okay. The state habeas court, Chief Judge Elrod, on that point said, we don't find that credible. There's no evidence to support that. That's a factual finding.
What about the friend of her father's stepfather's that sexually abused her starting at age 12? Or 13, but I think 12. Was that presented to the jury? And if not, did the defense counsel and or the prosecutor know that at the time to the contrary?
So I'm not talking about distinguishing between the various sexual assaults that she did testify to, Chief Judge Elrod, but again, you're going, I think, to a Wiggins theory, and if I can, I'd like to tell you what their investigation was, because it was extensive. And again, this is an AEDPA case. This is D1. Was it a misapplication of Strickland on this point? There is 88 pages of fact findings from the district court, the state habeas court, presumed correct under E1. They hired 2 experienced investigators and a mental health expert. They interviewed many witnesses, family members, acquaintances, prostitutes, drug addicts. One of her counsel walked the streets to go to a crack house to interview people at night. They interviewed Holberg multiple times. They interviewed her stepfather.
They didn't interview her father.
Who was in jail. Yes.
Right, but he was in jail in a very close place.
And he had no real impact on her life. But the question under AEDPA, again, is there a misapplication of Strickland? Here's what the cases they cite are. They cite if I can, they say, Porter, what happened in Porter? The attorneys did not even take the first step of interviewing witnesses or requesting records, so the jury heard almost nothing that would humanize the defendant. That's not what happened here. In Rautia, the attorneys failed entirely to examine the defendant's prior conviction file that it knew the prosecutors would use and which contained evidence depicting the defendant's childhood and mental health very differently from anything defense counsel had heard or seen. They had heard everything. In Wiggins...
So they had heard everything. They had...
They had heard information about her. Did they hear every single possible thing? I suspect not. Did they hear enough to tell them about her childhood? Yes.
Prosecutor didn't know, they didn't know this stuff? Or because they said she had a normal family with drug, the drug use is not more than normal, did they know that there was heroin and needles in the house and that they gave their children drugs and that they had them in the meth in the bathtub? Did the prosecutor, when they said at oral argument during the case, did the prosecutor know all these things or not at all?
I mentioned we had evidence about what the prosecutor knew about this.
Did the defense lawyer know?
They certainly knew that she had drugs. I don't know if they knew that there were...
That the parents had given her drugs and that this wasn't actually a normal family with a little bit of pot smoking.
Oh, she testified that her parents gave her Valium and marijuana at a young age. So they heard that. Did they hear the full extent of... Okay.
And then the last one I have on this is, you know, does Texas, I'm concerned that perhaps that when it's allowed that someone says, oh, the person was fine until they went boy crazy, when they know that they were molested as a 4-year-old and as a 12-year-old, that's not going boy crazy. That's a result, perhaps, but we don't know because it wasn't testified on, a result of years of being sexualized as a child. And that's not the same thing as being boy crazy. And if you're having sex at 12 and 13, you're not Lolita in this day and age. You are, it's a sexual abuse of a minor. And so does Texas have a viewpoint on this for someone who might be concerned about the mitigation in this case?
I agree with you, Judge Elrod, but that wasn't the theory of the defense. That was testified to by, I think, a witness. The theory of the defense was that she had a sort of bright future until her Aunt Karen was murdered, which sent her parents into a drug and alcohol-fueled sort of depression. There was testimony again from Holbrook herself, reintroduced to punishment, that indicated that her parents were less than stellar, let's say, and that's an understatement. They thought nothing of the sexual assault she reported. They allowed her to have drugs. But again, I want to refocus your questions through AEDPA again. This is AEDPA. We have 88 pages of findings of fact. Clear, presumed correct. We have the cases they cite where there was nothing, no investigation done. And that's, again, they're from Wiggins' claim here. This looks nothing like those cases that they cite, and so it would be hard for me to see how this court could hold there was a misapplication of Strickland contrary to him, or a reasonable application of Strickland, particularly like in Richter, where the Supreme Court in Richter says the more general the standard, the more leeway. I think the whatever else you can say, the defense counsel in this case did a certainly adequate performance into their investigation, and again, there's no prejudice. The State Habeas Court found that twice.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We have your argument. We appreciate it. Mr. Abernethy, you saved time for rebuttal, sir.
Mr. Abernethy, while you're getting it together, I'm right up here. I'll get you before you start to get mine in. Just quickly, come back to, we're at the relitigation bar. So just refresh my, we've been through the evidence, but just refresh my memory as to what your specific argument and case is that you're relying on to get you over the AEDPA relitigation hump. We've heard all about the trial, but you've got a lot in there, but just say it so I'll understand. What specifically is your argument about the relitigation bar in terms of what we have to hold here? What are the specific cases that you're relying on for the in-bank court in light of the bail opinion is gone?
Well, Your Honor, I think our fundamental disagreement with the state here and our fundamental argument on this is that banks, the principles that constitute the holdings of Brady and
Smith. That's not my question. I want to know, grapple with the EDPA statute and articulate it for me, for us. What is it, the holding you would have this court make with respect to the EDPA standards in light of this case? Don't you tell me what the facts in the case are. Do you follow me?
I hope so. Let me try again. Our argument is that if you apply the EDPA standard in 2254D, it was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law to hold that...
And the clearly established federal law was?
It's banks, primarily, that a paid informant...
Paid in this case? Paid in this case?
Not paid in this case.
Banks, was the informant paid in which case?
In the same case.
In the same case. And so this is not the same as Banks?
Well, that's our fundamental disagreement with the state.
How is it the same? All so right, we've heard a lot about...
Hold on.
Don't need co-counsel.
You're just... We'll elaborate on the point. But to what Judge Oldham is asking you, it's sort of the same. Narrowing it. So what I'm asking is not this, the shotgun shot, but the rifle shot, you know, clearly on these facts. That's all I'm asking. We read the briefs. I'm like, I just want to make sure I understand.
It's an unreasonable application of banks to conclude that because the paid agent of the state, Kirkpatrick, was paid in other cases, that it's not obligated, the state isn't obligated to disclose that she was a paid agent of the same police department, that distinction is not material, and it's an unreasonable application of banks to hold. You only have to disclose that this person is your paid agent if you're paying her in the same case. It doesn't go to the fundamental principle underlying banks, which is that paid informant testimony is inherently suspect. And when somebody, and it's, that's a fundamental principle of evidence law.
So we held the opposite in Dennis, and so Dennis was wrong?
Dennis was wrong.
Got it. And what is the state of the law in circuits across the country extending banks in the EDPA posture to paid informant status in other cases? Because we've heard a lot today, primarily from the bench, about paid this, paid agent, hired testimony. But there's no evidence, as I understand it, that she was paid in this case. And that any of her testimony was purchased in this case. She may have had other deals in other cases, but we've already held in Dennis that does not resurmount the litigation bar to Judge Stewart's question.
I don't remember the specific case names. I'm sorry, but there are two cases cited in our brief.
Well, you cited the Sixth Circuit Robinson decision, and it says, first, the facts show Sims assisted authorities as a CI in exchange was paid for his services, regardless of whether the cases were unrelated. Sims had a working relationship with law enforcement, including the agency spearheading the investigation of this case. Robinson was entitled to present such evidence to the jury. Second, the prosecutor's actual knowledge is irrelevant because the individual prosecutor has a duty to learn of any favorable evidence known to others acting on the government's behalf, citing Supreme Court Strickler. Moreover, regardless of whether the prosecution succeeds in meeting the obligation, its responsibility for failing to disclose favorable evidence rising to material level is inescapable, citing Kyles. So published circuit authority applying Kyles Strickler says paid informant status to the same police department, same time, is a fundamental Brady violation. Dennis, as we discussed earlier, not a guilt phase witness, not confession evidence, not paid. Is that all correct?
That's the essence of it. There are two reported cases that we cited where they were not paid in the same case. Your Honor, I'll just make a humble request, given the length of time that sentencing issues were discussed in response to your questions, if I could just have a couple of minutes to address the same questions you discussed with my learned adversary for the state.
You have 1 minute.
So the evidence is a lot more equivocal on future dangerousness. E.R. Williams died of pancreatic cancer, death certificate. The witnesses who said Holberg hit him over the head, they didn't believe her. And that, by the way, could have been the same kind of jailhouse talk that the prosecutor was talking about. talking about silencing Kirkpatrick. The witness who testified to that said, I didn't believe she actually intended violence. The state's expert, who clearly was important on sentence, relied on Kirkpatrick's testimony. And the state said several times, state's counsel, the brutality of the crime was sufficient to establish future dangerousness. Legally, it's sufficient, which went to the point we were making that it was a terrible strategy to rely heavily, if not entirely, on future dangerousness in sentencing. But it doesn't mean that Kirkpatrick wouldn't have had a material effect. In terms of your question, Your Honor, about what was known or not known, I obviously can't do that in 6 seconds, but it's reviewed in our brief. A lot of this either was not known, or defense counsel undermined it with other evidence in the sentencing case. That's Rompillo. Thank you for your indulgence, Your Honor.
Thank you. This case is submitted. The court will take a brief recess before considering the next case of the day.